Okay. I think we're ready to go forward here. We have next thing on the agenda tonight is to look at the homework from this class. So why don't we start with number one, and we'll just kind of work through them tonight. The people seem to have a lot of questions, and there's only 10 of them, so we might as well just go through them. Who wants to take a shot at number one?
It's the easy one. It's the one I know I got right.
He wants to jump in on that easy one first, so he's got it out of the way.
All right. What are the stages of carcinogenesis? All right, Genesis. I have initiation, which is the first stage, second stage, promotion/conversion.
Okay.
And the third stage is progression.
All right. So what happens in those stages? Now, let's elaborate on the answer a little bit.
Initiation is the is when one cell mutates.
The DNA is altered in the initiation stage, and in the second stage, the progression stage, the promotion stage, it is given more stimulus, and in the third stage, progression stage, the cell, the mutated cells divide and grow the cancer more.
Okay. Let's go to number two. Those are good answers. I like that. So number two, in what stage does mutation play a fundamental role in starting the process? And how do the E of T text and toxicology tutor differ in what they say about the role of mutation?
They both agree that it happens in initiation.
Okay.
But the E of T mentions non-genetic, non-mutational causes of cancer, or epigenetic, and I didn't see that in the Tox Tutor.
Yeah, Tox Tutor doesn't talk much about that. Tox Tutor suggests that mutation is important at all the stages, and indeed they do agree that it's important in progression, but they differ on the role in promotion. And so promotion could be just by other growth stimuli, like hormones, and it's not really causing mutation, it's just pushing the growth to happen. And so what are when you mentioned epigenetic mechanisms, what are some epigenetic mechanisms? Any thoughts? Hypermethylation. So what's hypermethylation?
Where certain regions of the DNA become hypermethylated, so they add methyl groups. And if it's in a promoter region, then it will serve to silence that gene.
Okay, so if you had a hypermethylation of a tumor suppressor gene, for example, that could be having a carcinogenic effect. And so it's a way of altering gene expression in ways that are kind of sticky. They last for a while. Perhaps not as permanently as a genetic mutation, but it's an alteration of the genetic function without actually changing the DNA sequence. And so you can have hypermethylation of DNA. You can also have acylation of histones, which are involved in regulating gene expression. And there are probably other things that can happen. But those are two that we know respond to environmental stimuli. And there's a very interesting paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences 3 or 4 years ago looking at methylation and acylation of DNA and histones, respectively, in identical twins. And I find that identical twins under age 3 have about 75% or more similarity in the way their DNA is methylated and their histones are acylated. But by the time they're in their 50s or 60s, and especially if they've lived apart and actually correlated with the amount of time they spent apart, they now differ with their DNA methylation and histone acylation, and they're only about 25% similar. So that identical twins, middle-aged or older, become more different. Their gene expression changes based on their experience, their what they've been exposed to. And it's not yet clear what kinds of things change that. I mean, most of the focus what people are thinking about is diet, chemical exposures, and so forth. And there's a big initiative to really focus on looking at what the relationship is between these epigenetic mechanisms and exposure to air pollution and to diet and so forth as being probably the major mechanism by which these things operate. One of the things that hasn't really been focused on very much and I think would be very interesting to do would be to look at what is the role of stress, of racial discrimination, of job discrimination, of all these sort of things that people in this department think about a lot. How do those things impact DNA methylation and acylation? It seems to me they must, because we know that these things have profound effect on lipids, on blood pressure, on cardiovascular mortality, on cancer. How does that happen?
The methylation was part of the mutagenic process. I thought methylation caused like base mispairing.
Well, there's two kinds. We're talking about, so you're right. There's alkylation, where you are adding alkyl groups or other kinds of thing, adducts to DNA. And that is, it's because the reaction products was xenobiotics with foreign chemicals. And that does cause mutation. But the methylation that we're talking about is a natural process that happens to the cytosines. Isn't it? I'm trying to think, is that Mike right on that? It's cytosine? Or is it guanine that gets methylated? CpG groups. Yeah, CpG islands, but it's the C's that get it, I think. But anyway, I have to check on that. But the point is that it's done by enzymes in a natural way, and it's part of the natural process of development. In fact, it's pretty clear that this is a major way that cells decide whether they're going to be neurons or skin cells or liver cells or whatever, that this is part of how you turn on and off genes. And it's part of why cloning animals is difficult, because if you take a skin cell and you want to clone, an animal from a skin cell or a liver cell or something, right? Well, that cell's DNA, it's got all the DNA that the whole body has, right? But it's got it turned on and off in a particular pattern, most of which is done by methylating the DNA and the histone acylation that determines that it's expressing the genes that it's supposed to express to be a liver cell. And what you got to do, so what they're doing then is taking the nucleus from this adult fully differentiated cell and plopping it into an egg, fertilized egg, right, after taking out the nucleus of that egg, and then trying to do things to it that gets it to start fresh with, reversing its methylation pattern. And it's not clear that really works 100%, so that's why the cloned animals may not be all that healthy animals, because some of them clearly have much more rapid age degenerative problems, because they started out with methylation, their methylation patterns not being really exactly like that one in an embryo. And so this is part of the issue with, so if you find stem cells for blood, right, if you can get a blood stem cell and then use that to try to, you know, reverse it back to being a real stem cell, for, you know, like it were a fertilized egg. Well, it's not, you know, there's a long way to go to really proving that, that you really got there. And of course, the people who don't want people experimenting with all the leftover eggs that people put in the freezer and are never going to use are, you know, are hoping, and everybody's hoping, that you can do it without dealing with that issue. But there's a lot, you got a lot of hurdles to get over to really know that you got there, that you really reversed all those processes that have programmed that cell to be a blood cell of some kind, not a brain cell and so forth. And most of that happens through this methylation project. So it's very, so that's separate. So I'm glad you asked that question, because so we're talking about, you know, forming adducts with xenobiotics, and we're and putting methyl groups on in an organized way in certain places. It's very different. Okay, number three. How do stimuli to cell growth contribute to carcinogenesis, and at what stage does that play a role? Okay.
Does it have to do with the allowance for uncontrolled cell growth, and that more cells are being produced than are dying off? Not so much.
Well, so what stage is it important in?
Promotion? No, not.
Well, in promotion and progression.
Okay.
And it's important because these, so what are some of these things that do it? What are some of the stimuli to cell growth?
I think I read one of the contributory factors to promotion is that you have to have continued exposure in order for the promotion or the mm-hmm. proliferation to continue. So the amount of exposure of whatever the chemical is would have to be continuous.
Right. Okay. So it because it's not causing mutation, it's just promoting growth. Right. So, and part of it is that it functions in fixing the mutation. So you can have a mutation in the cell, and if it's not forced to divide, it might get around to fixing it before it divides. But if you make it divide right away, and it doesn't have a chance to repair it, then you're stuck with that mutation.
I thought it was fixated in during the initiation stage.
Right, okay, but so obviously these stages are a little bit artificially defined, okay, but there is a role where growth promotion may, so what you're arguing is that, what I'm saying is that it's happening in growth promotion is important in initiation, and in a sense it is, in that, but, you know, even though the standard answer is that it would be in promotion and progression, but it's mainly, but even in promotion and progression, you're talking about things where, well, it's okay, so you have these initiation events that have happened where you had the mutation, right? So that would be the initiation, but does that initiation amount to anything? Well, only if there's growth, and there's stimuli to growth. And part of what I'm saying is going on in that stimuli to growth is that, well, that initial mutation might still have gotten repaired, okay, if it didn't, if you didn't make it grow.
But they could be from two different exposures, right? So you could have an initial mutation, and then 5 years down the road or something, you might have some kind of other exposure or something that causes the cell to proliferate over and over and over and over again that once was dormant and now is mutated that keeps...
Right, and so in that case, you may have the mutation was already pretty much fixed. It wasn't going to fix it.
Right.
And now you've stimulated it to start growing, and that's when you start getting into trouble with it. And if you just never stimulated it, you'd be fine.
Right.
and they may be to completely different exposures. Or it may be more of the same thing that's got some irritant property that also stimulates growth as well as mutating the cells.
But how does it? How do the cell growth stimuli work in progression?
Well, in progression, you still have, think about prostate cancer, for example, or a hormone sensitive breast cancer. So, one of the things we do in treatment is to block the hormone signals that turn on those cells, right? With tamoxifen or with DES or, you know, other things to block the hormone signal, so that by if it's a hormone sensitive cell, then it will slow down its growth, and that's at a stage where it's a clinically evident cancer. It's progressing, right, and metastasizing and so forth. So you're still affecting it at that stage by not giving it growth stimuli. But you're right that promotion is we think of it in promotion especially, but it's also important in progression. So what kind of genes are thought to be most important in carcinogenesis?
P53.
Well, that's a gene. I'd say what kind of genes?
Oh, I see.
Yeah. I heard mumble. Proto-oncogenes.
Because everybody's sick of being wrong. I sure am.
Well, you guys have been doing quite well, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean,
proto-oncogenes.
Proto-oncogenes and...
Oncogenes.
Yeah, or...
Both of them?
And
tumor suppressor genes. I mean, the way I answered it, I said proto-oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes, but I'll take oncogenes as well. But it's really... proto-oncogenes is the, you know, because that's the normal gene that then becomes a mutated gene and is the oncogene. And tumor suppressor genes and microRNA genes that have either proto-oncogenic or tumor suppressor activities. MicroRNA genes that have either proto-oncogene or tumor suppressor activities.
If you just had proto-oncogenes, is that
that's good
sufficient?
Well, but you should have tumor suppressor genes as well. Yeah, should be both, because one is a push-pull, mm-hmm. right? And so it's on both sides. But if you don't have microRNA, I'm not taking off anything. But realize that there are proteins and there are RNAs involved too now. What is an oncogene and how is it related to a proto-oncogene?
Oncogenes are altered proto-oncogenes, which now have the ability to direct the production of proteins within the cell that can change or transform the normal cell into a neoplastic cell. And they usually just differ by like one single mutation.
Great. Very good. So what is an epigenetic mechanism of carcinogenesis? We already sort of answered that, right? You want to go over it again? Okay.
Would there be hormonal? If there's like a hormonal, would that be an epigenetic?
She said, would a hormonal mechanism. Well, how I answered it, I said a mechanism that does not involve changes in the genetic code. Altered DNA methylation can increase or decrease activity of a gene, but, you know, a hormone it would be an epigenetic mechanism, too, because it's a promotion. Does not involve changes in DNA in the genetic code. So it's a mechanism that's not epigenetic. So it's outside of having to do with the change in the genetic code. And mostly we're talking about DNA methylation.
Can you just give a minute? If you just said epigenetics is used to refer to chromatin and DNA modifications that are stable over rounds of cell division.
That sounds good.
What do you say?
You want to say it again?
Sorry.
Say that epigenetics is used to refer to features such as chromatin and DNA modifications that are stable over rounds of cell division but do not involve changes.
Do not involve changes
in DNA sequence of the organism.
Exactly. Yeah, that's very, very well put. Okay, what is the relationship between reactive oxygen species and the observation that mild starvation increases lifespan and reduces cancer risk in rats?
Does metabolism itself create the reactive oxygen species? So if your metabolism slowed down, then you create fewer?
Yes. So I spent last week in Cyprus teaching at the Cyprus International Institute, and they took me out to dinner every night and probably shortened my life, right, because I ate all this wonderful food over there. So the normal metabolism generates reactive oxygen species, and the more food you process, the more ROS you generate. Thus, starvation is less ROS and less aging and cancer. Well, it's not exactly starvation, but dietary restriction.
Does it have something to do with insulin? I read somewhere that it has something to do with insulin.
Well, it may. I mean, that's one theory, in that insulin is a growth factor. And in fact, we talk about insulin-like growth factors having a lot to do with cancer and mutation of insulin-like growth factor genes as being proto-oncogenes become oncogenes. So insulin is a growth factor. And one of the things that you do when you this is probably more directly related to what kind of food you eat than how much you eat necessarily in terms of calories, because what happens is if you eat rapidly absorbed stuff that turns into glucose in your blood very fast, like a bagel, your blood sugar goes up quickly, right? And then you pump out a lot of insulin to bring it back down. And then your blood sugar goes low and you get hungry and you go eat another bagel, right? Whereas if you put a lot of cream cheese on the bagel or you have an ice cream, right? The ice cream, first of all, is actually, because it's got a lot of fat in it, much more slowly absorb the calories. And so your blood sugar rises more slowly, so you don't pump out a lot of insulin. And you don't get hungry right away afterwards. So then you don't eat again. And so so your insulin level remains more constant. You don't have these big bounces that are pumping out a lot of insulin. So that suggests that it has a lot to do with what you eat as well as how much you eat. How much the insulin production. And the insulin production, then, there's a lot of evidence that high insulin levels are more predictive of cardiovascular mortality than lipid levels and so forth. So that, and of course, you know, I don't know how much we're going to really get into diabetes in this course, but maybe we should, since that's a humongous health problem these days. But that as you as you have these high insulin levels, you know, that from a cancer point of view, that's a growth factor. But it's also having huge effects and much more obvious effects on your lipid metabolism, because what it's doing is trying to make all that blood sugar go into your fat cells. And that's then why you put on weight. Whereas if you exercise, your muscle sucks up all that glucose, and then you don't need the insulin. Number 8 is, what is the endpoint used in the Ames short-term test for carcinogenic risk?
Basically, to test for the ability for the bacteria to produce its own histidine.
Right.
Because it's cysteine deficient.
And so what it is, it's a reversion mutation, because normally the bug can do that, and they have bugs that are selected for not being able to grow in the absence of histidine, and so then you plate them on a plate with no histidine, and if they grow, that's a mutation.
Well,
the endpoint is a mutation of the ability to grow in the presence of histidine. So it's a mutation that's a nutritional mutation, which makes it, that's what makes it a nice, convenient test, because you can then just grow the bacteria in the absence of histidine, and it won't grow if it didn't mutate. What is the gold standard? Well, one other thing is that you should know, but this is not required as part of the answer, but there are actually two different Salmonella strains that he used. And one of them that require two different kinds of mutation to revert. One of them has just one base pair that's changed. And so it's got to change back to what it was in order for it to become functional. And the other one actually has a deletion, I think it is. And so it's called a frame shift mutation. So it's shifted, you know, if it's missing a pair, right, then when it reads in threes to figure out what amino acids it's making, it's then everything after that is shifted, so then it's just complete nonsense codes from there on out. And so it has to then have a mutation that can get it back into the frame it was supposed to by inserting what it's missing. And so those are caused by two very different kinds of chemical mechanisms. And in that way, he had two strains that could pick up different kinds of chemical mutation mechanisms.
So what if you put backward or forward mutations in specific bacterial strains?
Yeah, okay. Yes, that's good. I would prefer that you put down something about the histidine, but
okay.
But I'll accept that. It's mutation. That's half of the answer, and the other half of the answer is that it's, you know, that you know something more about what it was doing. What is the gold standard for determining potential carcinogenic activity of a chemical? What is the measured outcome of the assay?
The chronic 2-year bioassay for carcinogenicity in rodents.
Okay.
And the outcome, the detection of tumors in all organs. That's what it said in the book.
Great. That's correct. Really? You must be doing better than that. I mean, you've all done really great up to this time, so I'm really. This one's. Well, the other ones all came out of Tox Tutor, so you can really just look up the answer, right?
The book, personally, for me, the book is a difficult read.
The book is. Now, did you find that last year some people told me they thought this book was more difficult because it left stuff out than actually reading the big book?
I might have to go back to the big book and see if that makes any difference for the next homework.
It does. Not so much.
Yeah, the big book is a big book.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I've got some other books publishers are sending me saying, well, evaluate this book for the class. So, you know, I will start looking at it and seeing what the options are.
I think something written in English will help.
Well, that might be hard to come by. We'll see. We did number 9. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
You're putting in the N, yeah. But the chronic 2-year bioassay is what I was looking for. If you've added more information than that, the point is that it's 2 years and you're looking for tumors. What are the 3 important common indoor airborne carcinogenic exposures? What, can you come up with names of 3?
I mean, I had exposure to fine particulates, environmental tobacco smoke, and radon, and then also I found that fumes such as like for burning coals and woods within your home.
Excellent. Anybody have additional
cleaning solutions that might have benzene even a little bit, for example?
Okay.
I had specific ones that are listed in the back of the book: asbestos, arsenic, and benzene.
Okay.
What about mold?
What about mold? That's a good one. Well, certainly there are mycotoxins that are carcinogenic. Now, the question about a couple of these things is, to what extent are they airborne in the home? So asbestos, you might find airborne in the home. You know, you have old houses with asbestos furnace lagging and pipes and stuff. Certainly, I grew up in a house with asbestos in it. And I used to do chin-ups on the bars. So I'm sure I was pumping the asbestos out of the lining when I'm pulling up on them.
You're even here.
Well, yeah, and then when you talk about my dad and all the final chloride exposure he had in the 40s, and then my mom took DES, it's amazing that I'm here, right? So... maybe this is my interest in teaching this course. I don't know. But arsenic, would you have airborne arsenic in the home?
Well, I wouldn't think so, but I mean, I didn't see it as home. I guess I was looking at indoors.
Or indoors, yeah.
There's no home.
Okay. That's right. Okay, that's in my head. I need to put that into the question next year.
I mean, the book didn't really break down where the exposure could occur. They just said where might result in some kind of cancer, so I assume that anything might have some kind of throat or bronchial type mm-hmm. cancer, mm-hmm. then it would be as a result of breathing it in.
But, well, a lot arsenic exposure is through water, unless you're working in smelting industries. It's mainly water exposure,
right.
oral exposure.
I'm just going on what the book gave, so that's all.
The book talks about arsenic as an airborne exposure?
No, but it's just...
industries and trades, yeah. So arsenic is listed there under copper mining and smelting, yeah. But, okay. I'm going to have to be better, a little tighter about it being the indoor home exposures next year. We'll get away from smelters. But smelters, I suppose there's indoor components to a smelter.
So I wrote those down as well, but I also had, I had radon and I changed it, but I think that would be a good source for it.
Yes, radon is very important indoor airborne exposure, and is probably responsible for a large fraction of the lung cancer among non-smokers. That's very important. Okay. Well, that's good.
So, is there one particular place for those answers?
No. No, that was the think about this and kind of look at what you're reading and pull it together question. Yeah.